Okay. Today we're going to work on a teisho or a koan from the Book of Equanimity. Kyuho Head and Tail, number 66. It's a bit ambiguous, this particular koan, to say the least. But I mean, that's, you know, in a way, that is the function of koans. I'll talk more about function again today. Because if it's black and white, then we can very get easily stuck in black and white. So the idea, keep in mind, with koans is to somehow enter into a state of mind and use a koan as a vehicle or a medium, if you like, that gets us into that state of mind, and just let that evolve, whatever evolves as we're going through the koan. So we have an introduction, and the introduction here is by Master Wanchi. He collected the koans, he wrote the introduction about 100 years after Master Bancho collected them in the 12th century. So just a little bit on that. Okay, I'll like to read the koan out first. The instruction. Even a person who can apply supernatural powers cannot let a foot down. Even a person who forgot all karma ties and extinguished all thoughts cannot raise a foot. You should say, sometimes you kill by running and sometimes you kill by sitting. How can you attain proper balance? The case. A monk asked Kyuho, what is the head? Kyuho said, opening the eyes and not perceiving the dawn. The monk said, what is the tail? Kyuho said, not sitting on 10,000-year-old sitting place. The monk said, what if there is a head but no tail? Kyuho said, after all, it is not valuable. The monk said, what if there is a tail but no head? Kyuho said, being complacent yet having no power. The monk said, what if the head matches the tail? Kyuho said, the descendants will prosper, but it is not known in the room. And then the verse. Round for a compass, square for a ruler. When used, it functions. When cast away, it hides. When stumbling, a bird living in the reeds, unable to go forward or backward. A sheep stuck in the hedge. Eating rice of other people, sleeping in one's own bed. Clouds come up and cause rain. Dew forms and becomes frost. The jade lines cross each other and go through the eyes of needles. The baldaquin threads constantly rush out of the weaving shuttles. The stone woman's loom stops and the color of the night turns to moon. The wood person walks on the road, and the moon is gone beyond the midnight. Now, I hope you all made sense out of this. So, this particular koan, as I said, is quite ambiguous. But actually, you know, we need to work on this very diligently, in the sense that in a koan like that, because it is the Book of Equanimity, we don't work on the instructions and we don't work on the verse. A student only works on the koan. But the verse and the instructions give us some clue as to what's happening in the koan. Okay. So, and by the time we get to this, that's quite a few hundred koans down the track, a lot of it will already start making sense, because there is a certain... there is a certain way that we work with koans that becomes familiar for those that are not used to working with koans by that time. But anyway, this particular koan really requires the student to be very meticulous, as in going through there and saying, what is actually meant? We can easily look at this and just disregard it and say, oh, this is too complicated. How am I ever going to find out what this is all about? Okay. But even so, there are commentaries that we can also avail ourselves to in the forms of teishos written by other people that are now published in books, and so we can get somehow, you know, get our head around this. And I encourage you to do that when the time comes. So let's just start. Let's just start with the introduction, and it is a beauty. So first of all, even a person who can apply supernatural powers cannot let a foot down. That is quite a statement. Even a person who cannot apply supernatural powers cannot let a foot down. So let's look at what are meant by supernatural natural powers. Remember, this was written being the instruction. This was written probably in the 12th century, whereas the Koan dialogue happens much earlier than that. So we've got to always look at it from the world view of that time as well. So supernatural powers in those days are different, or maybe not, to the way we would interpret them today. So today you might say, what are supernatural powers? Looking at it in a context of religion or in a context of spirituality, you might say, if you go to a church and they do healing, that is supernatural power. You know, you have some churches where they actually lay their hands on people, and then all of a sudden we see it sometimes on television, miraculously people are healed. That is supernatural power. It's basically something, the way I look at it, it is a power that is not evidence-based. Supernatural, it's something that we can't really somehow prove it through scientific methods. That is what is a supernatural power. But nevertheless, there are people with supernatural powers. We hear about it all the time. So another way of looking at this is, when we practice concentration, and we, through concentration, remember this, the first aim is to attain joriki, the power of concentration. That does give us a certain power. It's just like when you go to the gym, as I always say in the introductory talk, you know, lifting weights develops muscles, and by the time we've got some muscles and we've done it for a while, we have a certain power. We can lift more. That there's a power that we have, being able to lift more weights. Same with concentration. If we really practice concentration, that gives us power. Power to hold our attention. Not a lot of people have got that power to be really being able to hold our concentration. Or even that even may manifest physically, that we can go through certain pains because we can endure it. We are building resilience even in the body to be able to endure, whether it is pain or even mental anguish. That is a certain power. And some people might look at that and say that is supernatural power. Okay. So anyway, that's just on the supernatural power. Then it says, even a person that has got that cannot let a foot down. Cannot let a foot down. So what's meant by that? And again, this is something we can say, oh, I don't know, and you move on. But actually, there's a koan here. And if for those that are working on the miscellaneous koans, there are koans relating to that. You know, lifting a foot or putting a foot down. Can we actually do that? You know, of course you might say that's a stupid thing to say. Of course I can lift the foot down and I can lift the leg up. But when you look at it from the perspective of the absolute, from the perspective of Zen that we are always talking about here, who is lifting a leg? What is a leg? Same as question is, what is dog? What is a dog? You know, what is leg? How do we look at it? So for me to be able to say, yes, I can put a foot down, or yes, I can lift the leg up, I am already in a state of mind that is very determined, that is conventional in the sense that is a leg and this is not a leg. I'm looking at it in a very specific way, and only from that way. If I only look at it from that way, I can't deviate. I can't go beyond what it is, what a foot is. And if I can't go beyond what a foot is, then, well, I'm stuck there. I'm stuck with foot. or leg or head or wood or metal or building or whatever it is that I'm talking about. I am stuck in the convention. I'm stuck in the story of it. I cannot go beyond that. So he's saying, even if you have got supernatural powers, even if you concentrate and you got your Reiki, you cannot even let a foot down. You haven't reached that point yet in your practice where you can see that you can't let a foot down. You've got all the power in the world. In other words, meditation doesn't get you there. That's just a way of getting us there. But that is not it. You know, you have not got the power yet to put a foot down. That is what is meant by this. So you can look at those two as the difference between concentration and awakening. You need to be awakened to be able to see that you cannot lay the foot down. But that's the difference between awakening and concentration. So that is in that first sentence of that introduction. Even a person who cannot apply supernatural powers cannot let a foot down. Even a person who forgot all karma ties, it goes on to say, and extinguished all thoughts cannot raise a foot. So, forgot all karma ties is a Buddhist concept. And those of you that know a little bit about Buddhism, forgot all karma ties is like when in classical Buddhism, in the Theravadan, and certainly in the Theravadan sutras, it says very clearly the person, the arahant, one of the signs that an arahant is like a holy person, someone that has sort of the highest level in the Theravadan tradition, it is someone that has extinguished all karma. Okay. Now, what does that mean, having extinguished all karma? Has extinguished the causality, if you like, of past and future, have extinguished it. And there can be many, many different interpretations of that. But just a very simple one. When I'm triggered and I get angry, there's nothing I could do about it. It just happens. That's my karma. Okay. So if I am no longer triggered, it's also my karma, of course. But if I'm no longer triggered and I no longer get angry, you know, that is, I've developed my practice sufficiently that I've extinguished all my karma. I've developed my personality or my conduct to such a degree that anger doesn't even arise. No matter what happens to me, anger doesn't arise anymore. That is what is meant by extinguishing all karma. You know, most of us are not at that level. You know, we just need to have something happening and we flare up. You know, buttons are being pushed. That's a sign that we have not extinguished all karma. Okay, so that is what that's. So even a person who forgot all karma ties, in other words, they've got to such a high level where nothing can disturb their peace anymore. The ego is no longer threatened. And usually when an ego is threatened, that's because an ego needs separation. It needs a me and it needs a you. That's what it is. It needs separation. So when all of that karma tie is gone, you know, then that is in classical Buddhism that equates to being an arahant. Okay, so that's sort of one of the signs that needs to happen before you're called an arahant. But here it says, even a person that's achieved that level and extinguished all thoughts, in other words, they've deep samadhi, you know, cannot raise a foot. So cannot raise a foot, a person like that. So again, it's that they cannot raise a foot, you know. Just, you know, some of you may see that, but that is what this person is saying. Even a person like that cannot raise a foot. Why? That's a question for Dr. Sanrum. Why can that person not raise a foot? You know, that's a koan, if you like, that should be answered in the Dokusan room. Then it goes on. You should say, sometimes you kill by running, sometimes you kill by sitting. How can you attain the proper balance? So again, that's a strange sentence. Sometimes you kill by running, sometimes you kill by sitting. What's meant by this? And of course, we all know when we talk about killing in Zen, it's a very strong word, killing. Yeah? It usually refers to extinguishing what? We extinguish concepts. The biggest concept, of course, is self, ourself. So if I extinguish myself completely, I ask you, what is left? What is left? That's where this points to. You know. So killing by running, killing by sitting, killing by driving, killing by operating, killing by carpentry, killing by physiotherapy, killing by engineering, killing all the time. Concept of self, and when that happens, what is left? That's the question. That is the question. I think this is one of the most important lines in this entire koan. You know, what is really left? You know, of course, there's a lovely analogy in running. You know, we all know the runners that let go of themselves. There's just the flow. There's just running. And those that are runners, they just know, you know. You know. But this is like, I don't want to compare the two, but this sort of goes along the lines of really letting go where there is no you and me and then what is left, just running, you know. So this is what this would point to. You should say, sometimes you kill by running, sometimes you kill by sitting. By the way, I looked at another translation because quite often in these koans, looking at different translations, you get different translators put different emphasis on different words. And another translation goes, sometimes there are the running dead and sometimes there are the sitting dead, you know. And that's also a beautiful way of saying the same thing, you know, already dead. You know, dead while running, you know. In other words, the self is gone, it's dead, you know. To be able to say that, to be able to get to a state of mind where we are, where the self is dead, you know, this is what this points to. Okay. And then, how can you attain the proper balance? Okay, how do you get to that point? And that is now pointing to the koan. Look at the koan. There it is, in the koan, how you get that balance. So that's what it says. So let's look at this koan. A monk asked Kyuho, "What is the head?" And Kyuho said, "Opening the eyes and not perceiving the dawn." What is the head? Opening the eyes and not perceiving the dawn. Of course, you could now speculate what is the head and what is, you know, and of course it keeps going about the tail. But first of all, what is the head? Okay. So we now need to somehow look for clues. What's the head? You know, it says opening the eyes. Well, that's very clear. When we open our eyes, and you've got to remember, this is always in the context of Zen. You know, when we open eyes means, you know, opening the eyes means awakening. When we got a clarity, opening the eyes like a Kensho experience would be opening the eyes. All of a sudden, we change perspective. We've gone beyond that dualistic framing. We've all of a sudden come to a point where we've killed the eye, if you like. And at that moment, just at that brief moment, we open our eyes and we see that glimpse. So what is the head? And the monk asked, very interesting question, what is the head? And Kyoho answered, opening the eyes, not perceiving the dawn. So dawn here, not perceiving the dawn. And again, this is very poetic, you know. Not perceiving the dawn refers to not seeing clearly. How many people fall in that situation? We have Kensho experiences, but we don't see clearly, you know. Looking at my own journey, I still don't see clearly. It's like that's a process that happens. That seeing clearly is a process that happens. So opening the eyes, we might get a reference point, but seeing clearly, that takes a while. That takes quite a while. Some people may be lucky where You might see clearly at that moment. It cannot be clearer than that. But then, oh, we fall back into our delusional thinking, and at that moment we're losing it. You know. But so what is, coming back to that, what is the head opening the eyes and not perceiving the dawn? Something is still missing as we go along. It does not last. That it doesn't last, that clarity that we get at that initial moment. And of course, most people that are working on koans, that is the function of koans, is to clarify that little glimpse. We need to have a glimpse sufficient enough to start koans, but once we are on koans, that clarification process is there to making sure that we can see clearer and clearer the dawn. You know, that's what that refers to. Interestingly, again, different interpretations. I looked at Yamada Koan's Roshi on this koan. Sorry, Yamada Koan's Teisho on this koan, and he said his interpretation of this line is being self-absorbed, being still self-absorbed, and not being yet at that level of saving all sentient beings. In other words, being still so self-absorbed that we're not ready yet to let go of still self-development, still needing more and more and more to build ourselves, and not yet ready to sort of let go of that and be out there and save all sentient beings, as he puts it. And the other one, I just made a note here. Yes, it's being still at that level where we are concerned about our own happiness, not other people's happiness. And just one thing that comes to mind here too is that when we had that experience, it's not at the level yet where we can't but be of total service. You know, it's a little bit like we see so much suffering, and yet we're not yet at that stage. That stage may, who knows when that stage comes or whether it'll ever come. We are not yet at that stage of turning our life around towards that total service. That's the way he interprets that. Okay, the monk said, "What is the tale?" That's another question. What is the tale? And Kyo said, not sitting on a 10,000-year-old sitting place. Okay. What is the tail? Okay. So what's the head? That's that Kensho experience, if you like, or that awakening experience, but still not seeing clearly. So what is the tail? And here the answer is not sitting on a 10,000-year-old sitting place. Like Buddha, he is sitting on a 10,000-year-old sitting place right there. He's still sitting 2,500 years. He's still there, right there sitting. It's a little bit like if we stay there, if we stay on our cushion and we don't move, that is the tail. Not sitting on a 10. We need to be able to get off our bums, you know, and actually become useful. That is what this refers to, and actually move forward, you know, both in clarity and also in action. You know, that's what this is sort of commonly what this is referred to, not sitting on the 10,000-year-old sitting place. And again, of course, we know people that are like that. We have people that are, some people, and as I always say, and I've said it many times, I personally believe it's important that there are people actually that push themselves further, and as long as that's what they do, push themselves further and further and further away to see where how far they can go with their consciousness. If it wouldn't have been for people like that, we wouldn't know how far we can go. So they are models in one way. But we can also get extremely comfortable in our practice and in our sitting and just stay there. And we just stay there and say, oh, well, it'll happen when it'll happen. And just wonder when, you know, and just life goes on. We don't do anything. That's another point. So again, here with this koan, it's challenging. And we can take it on. I mean, you might have a different interpretation. And No interpretation is right or wrong. It's just we can take these, we can take this koan on in many different ways and apply it as such. So not sitting on a 10,000-year-old sitting place. Okay, then we move on to the monk further said, what if there is a head? So what if there is a head? So we've had realization, but no tail. There is, what about if there is realization, but there is no tail? Okay. Kyushu said, after all, it is not valuable. So again, you've heard me, we've talked about this before. After all, it is not valuable, meaning if we had, if we have a, if no matter how clear it is, if we don't put it into action, it's not valuable. That's what that is what it's saying here. So you could say almost like, you know, a very wealthy people sitting on their yacht. You know, it's like it would be a secular way of looking at it. It is sad to see that a very wealthy person sitting on their yacht all day long. You know, and it's very, they've got all that wealth, they can do so many things. You sit on the yacht, you know, or you can say an able-bodied person, you know, just watching telly, you know. It's another way of looking at it, you know. That is very sad, again. Or if you apply it in a religious context, you know, you could you could almost just be so content with it, you know, that you maybe you might have another motive where you might want to say, oh, I can make money with this. Maybe that's, this is Yamada Roshi says, he mentions this in his stage. He said, some people make money with Zen, you know. So you could, it can become a self-serving thing, self-serving, where you start all of a sudden selling it. And you, all of a sudden the motivation goes maybe from it being of service and helping other people to maybe profit. That could become a profit thing. There was one a Zen person in America, I remember at the time, it was all over the news. They charged, I think it was 50,000 US dollars for a session for business people and promised Kensho, you know. And the that happened. That actually happened. I remember reading it myself. And I looked into it. And, of course, and this was one particular Roshi. And he had the same teacher as some of the most selfless. His dharmas and brothers were some of the most selfless Roshis that were like Bernie Glassman and Joan Halifax and some of these most selfless Roshis that were out there. That was a dharma. A brother of those people, you know. So here you can easily see that. And when he was interviewed about that, interestingly, he dismissed it as saying, and to what degree is right or wrong, I don't know, but he dismissed it as saying, I wanted to see, you know, these sorts of people that he marketed Zen to, he labeled it something different, and he created this whole sort of mystique around it. He said, they do not value it unless they put $50,000 for a weekend on the table. They just wouldn't even go unless there was something like that. And there is a point to that. Some people, they don't value it if it's free or if it's, you know, there's just no value in it. It takes a certain humility to see, you know, to go to something that is free, actually. So anyway, that was his justification. But then you look at other teachers like Thich Nhat Hanh or, you know, that are, you know, very selfless as well. So luckily they outnumber those ones that are not. Okay. So, okay, the monk said, what if there is a head but no tail? So in other words, it's not really put into its proper action. You know, if we have this experience, it's not really put into its proper action. And there's something not right. The function, there's something not right with this whole thing. And we can smell, most people can sort of sniff it out straight away if there is something not right with that. It can become self-serving. That is really what is meant with it. And he says, after all, it is not valuable. It is not valuable. Having just awakening on its own is not valuable. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't do any good at all. The monk further said, okay, now what if there is a tail? In other words, there's altruism, you know, saving the world. And we see a lot of that. What if there is a tail? He said, but no head. In other words, we really haven't seen yet that world of oneness. We haven't seen, we haven't clarified anything. We are just stuck in this saving the world, without realizing that there's actually nothing to save. That's another big danger. And when I read this morning, what came to mind was COP26, actually. You know, when I look at all these people, there's a big problem with climate, and then you've got all these people going there to do good. And no doubt they all do good, but it's totally self-serving, and nothing can happen. Well, nothing can really happen while it is that self-serving. So in other words, to me, that's an image of samsara. We go around and around and around and around and around and around. It just never stops. It'll be something else after the climate thing. I mean, I'm not a climate activist, and I don't want to go there as in against it. But it's that sort of thing. What if if we don't really see clearly what this is about, you know, we cannot get to the guts of the problem. We can only sort of play at it, and what gets in the way? Self-interest. Always gets in the way. Self-interest gets in the way. And that, of course, is the big challenge, is to let go, is to to kill that self-interest. And there are, I would say, very, 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 very few people that have come to that level, that where we can say, yes, that is a person that has actually achieved that. And that just shows you how difficult it is. And who comes to mind to me is like people like Gandhi, or people like Mother Teresa, or maybe Nelson Mandela. You know, these are giants in completely serving without any self-interest. You know, looking at it, these are the giants, and these are our role models that we have. But what is very sad, in a way, is that takes such a commitment that it is so rare, you know. And of course that is, but these are nevertheless, the way I look at it. And it would be extremely hard to be at that level. But nevertheless, there are some people there that have achieved that. So of course, just coming back, coming back to what if there is a tail but no head? In every part of society, we see there is a tail but no head. In other words, people want to do good, but there is really no underlying understanding of really what needs to be done. Because we all look at it from our self perspective. We're all self-referencing all the time, even self-referencing in the sense of our function. Like you look at right now with COVID, you look at the health system. The health system looks at it from a health system. The economists look at it from an economic system, each one from their own perspective. Then the politicians look at it from the perspective of getting the only validation they have is getting re-elected. So they're looking at it from a re-election point of view, whatever drives the population. So it's like that is the way it functions. That is the way the system functions. And it's very difficult to be clear about that and to see through that, you know, and not get caught up in it. That is, of course, the challenge that we have. Even in the therapeutic realm, you know, we can easily fall into this, you know, being stuck in a psychological way or being stuck in a Zen way. Oh, no, Zen is the way. Only Zen is the way. We can easily get stuck in our perspectives, which is also a self-serving function. The other thing on that, how do we get out of that? And what came to mind was the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path in Zen, in Buddhism, is the way out of suffering. Now, when we look at the way, you know, we all know the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering, the arising, and the cessation. Arising and cessation. Cessation you can equal with nirvana. And there's a path leading to that cessation, leading out of suffering, which is the Eightfold Path. And in Zen, of course, we don't go into the categories of the Eightfold Path. It's not, we're not teaching doctrine here. But our practices are the same practices that if you like, that they're the methods of getting towards embodying the Eightfold Path, which is concentration, wisdom, having some wisdom, and also having ethical principles and the precepts. So they're the three aspects of the Eightfold Path. And then once we've practiced those, which we practice, that's our practice, are those three principles. Once we practice those, the Eightfold Path elements, the path elements, will manifest themselves. That's like that karma I was talking about before, that it just will eventually, they will manifest themselves in our lives. But I'd like to read them out this time, the Eightfold Path elements. And it's always prefaced by right. Right, like the first one is right understanding. Okay, so right here means, it already means that head part. We've got to have, in order to have right understanding, we cannot be stuck in samsara. I mean, I can easily say, oh, that's right understanding. But if you can argue with it, we're caught in that duality. So right understanding, right is really important here. Right understanding is really clearly seeing it. Clearly seeing it. And of course, right understanding refers to the way it is. That's the way it is. Really clearly seeing it the way it is. So anyway, right understanding, right thought, you know, right through our practice, right thought will evolve. You know, right speech. If we have right speech, right thought, if we have right speech, we need to have right thought. Otherwise, it goes together. You know, we can have wrong thought and right and wrong speech. You know, but both of them, if they align, if speech and thought align, that is what is meant here. Right action. So first, right understanding and right thought comes back to wisdom. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood are the next ones. Right livelihood, right action, right speech comes to ethics. Right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration comes under the umbrella of concentration. So they're the Eightfold Path elements. Lots of it is written about. If you're interested, you can go into it and have a look at that. Okay. Let's just keep going. So we were looking at, the monk said, what is there is a tail but no head. In other words, there's lots of good action, there's altruism, but we haven't had that clarity yet. You know, being complacent but having no power. Having no power. And again, that is interesting, isn't it? You've got all just that no power part. Coming back to that COP26, with all the money that is there, all the nations that are there, there is no power. There is no power for them to change it. That is unbelievable if you think about it. You've got all these nations there, and yet there's no power. And that is exactly what is meant by this. There is no power, you know, because there is no clarity. There's everyone, they're not clear. They're not there. Everyone is... There's just so much confusion. There is no power, you know. And that's the same, of course, in our own little lives. If we don't have, you know, if we don't see that, we also have no agency. We also have not the power. Okay, it continues. Gyoho said, okay, where are we? The monk said, what if the head matches the tail? Okay, so now, what if the head matches the tail? What if the head matches the tail? Those two together. Kyoho said, the descendants will prosper, but it is not known in the room. The descendants will prosper, but it is not known in the room. So, again, it's just a beautiful way of expressing it. It is, you know, the descendants. Who are the descendants? Doesn't mean Zen descendants. Our descendants means the lead, you know, humanity. You can see that as humanity will prosper, you know. But it is not known in the room, because as soon as you know it, you're falling back into, oh, this is right, this is wrong. This is it. It is an organic way It isn't okay. And by the way, I would argue that that's how the world functions anyway. We just don't see it. Most people don't. That is how the world completely functions. Which, not on the news. That's where it doesn't function. On the news, at all. But actually underlying that, it functions magnificently. You know, climate change just marches on. You know, but of course, in our head, we just see all the problems. You know, but underlying all of that, every day is a good day. You know, that is really, you know, that is really what is meant by that. The descendants will prosper, but it is not known in the room. We get stuck with, no, it's not a good day. Certainly not at COP when they when they finished writing that that last statement or whatever it was. So many ways of looking at that as well. It is not known in the room. Also, Yamada Roshi, he said on this, that's like, it's effortless, which I like as well. It's effortless. It's like our practice when we let go, you know, of whatever it is. And it takes us a while to get to that point of even on the cushion to let go. All of a sudden, it's effortless. Same with running. Running. All of a sudden, running runs itself. We let go and it becomes effortless. So that's really what is meant by that. Not known in the room. Okay, the verse. Round for a compass, square for a ruler. When it functions, when used, it functions. When cast away, it hides. Obviously, to draw a circle with a ruler is quite difficult. You know, so round for a compass, square of a ruler. It's a way of expressing that effortless function. Of course, you use a compass for a circle, and to make a square, you use a linear ruler. It's just so basic, you know. But if we go against that basicness, and all hell breaks loose. When used, it functions. In other words, when we use that, when we go with that, and we see that, it just functions. You know, when cast away, it hides. Now, again, quite a few interpretations on that. When cast, it functions. When used, it functions. So when used, it functions. Like the head matches the tail, you could say. If I use a chair, it functions. If I don't use a chair, I let it go. If you say something to me that I perceive as being hurtful, perfect functioning. You just said something, it's a fact. Now I perceive something that is hurtful, I'm not casting it away any longer. I am now deliberately working on it. So when, and of course, working on it as in replaying that story in my head, that in itself creates turmoil. So I am going, I'm not casting it away. And you can see that as a metaphor, if you like, for holding on to the past. Yeah, when you look at all of our problems, all of our anxieties, they are because we are not casting away. With all this functioning is just like happening every day perfectly, but we're not casting it away. We're holding on. If it's bad, we're holding on because we relive it. And if it's good, we're holding on because we don't want to let it go. It's like we're not casting it away. So when that's sort of that image here. When used, it functions. When cast away, it hides. When stumbling, a bird living in the reeds. So when stumbling, a bird, it's like a bird living in the reeds. Like that, when stumbling, when the delusions arise, when we get caught up in things. Oh, why did she say that? And oh, I've got to go to work tomorrow. I don't really want to go to work. I should really have another job. Oh, why can't I be retired by now? Why haven't I got more money? Why? When stumbling, like a bird living in the reeds. There's all these reeds around us. All these all this stuff we got to get through. You know, that's the image here. Unable to go forward or backward, a sheep stuck in the hedge. Unable to go forward or backward, like a sheep stuck in the hedge. It's a very sad sight, actually, to see that. I don't know if you've ever seen a sheep stuck in a hedge, especially if it's barbed wire. Unable to go forward or backward, a sheep stuck in the hedge. Eating rice of other people, sleeping in one's own bed. What does that mean? Eating rice of other people, sleeping in one's own bed. So, eating rice of other people, according to Yamada Roshi, means eating other people's wisdom or other people's experiences, or taking on what other people are saying. You could even say reading sutras. So other people have written that down without us having digested it or realized it ourselves. So we're taking it on as a concept. We're taking it on as a concept. And we believe it. That is eating other people's rice. That's what this refers to. And sleeping in one's own bed, again, different interpretations. I'll get to that in a second. There was another person called Mokuzen. I don't know who he is, Mokuzen. He says, he refers to this as gobbling up other people's ideas. Gobbling up other people's ideas. That's, you know, eating rice of other people. So eating Buddhist principles or gobbling up other people's ideas. Or practices. Okay. Now, sleeping in one's own bed, again, different ways we can look at it. And again, I invite you to sort of get into this. It's eating other people's rice, eating rice of other people, sleeping in one's own bed. In other words, but we're still snuck. We're still smuck in our own bed. You know, we haven't made anything our own. We're still in our, we've got all the teachings, we've got our practice, but we're still on our little cushion, this is the way it should be. We're still in this sort of comfort, in our own comfort zone. We haven't gone beyond it. Yeah. So that's another way of looking at that. Or we sleep in a bed of illusions, as Mokuzen said. We still sleep in our own bed of our own delusions, you know. So that's quite challenging, eating rice of other people, sleeping in one's own bed. And it's meant to be challenging. And of course, which one is the tail? And this refers to the tail and the head again. Clouds come up and cause rain. Dew forms and becomes frost. So here's that perfect functioning again, that perfect causality. You know, being able to see that very, very clearly, you know, that clouds come up and cause rain, dew forms and become frost. Even though that is conventional, based on past and future, and nothing, we all know nothing becomes anything and all of this, but be able to see that just very clearly. Clouds come up and cause rain, dew forms, becomes frost. It's not confusing at all. It's just like that. You know, I remember once Rosalind, I think I told that story before, Rosalind was once asked in a forum, what is Zen? And she said, when it rains, I get wet. You know, that was her answer. When it rains, I get wet. And of course, she was criticized for that comment because they weren't ready to hear that yet. You know, it wasn't appropriate at the time. But nevertheless, that's what it is. You know, when it rains, I get wet. And actually, that's our practice, to get to a point. That is, the eye is gone. There's nothing else. When it rains, I get wet. That's it. You know, there is nothing else to get. You know, looking at it from an uncomplicated way, such a simple way, to be able to see that like that. This is what this line is pointing to. Now it gets very poetic. The jade lines cross each other and go through the eyes of needles. The jade line. So when you look at a jade, stone, or marble, there are lines there. You know, they're just form. Nature forms those lines, those jade lines. So the jade lines cross each other and go through the eyes of needle. So perfect harmony. Go through the, it's very hard to go through an eye of a needle, but they do. They go through the eye of the needle, you know. They just match the situation, whatever those jade lines, whatever the situation of jade is. The baldaquin threads, I had to look that up, what a baldaquin is. A baldaquin is a ceremonial canopy of fabric over a throne. That's a baldaquin. You know, one of those fancy textile structures that sit over a throne or an altar. The baldaquin threads constantly rush out of weaving shuttles. So that, again, that perfect functioning. See that perfect functioning again here. The stone woman's loom stops. Very poetic. The stone woman's loom stops. When I looked at this, I thought of this cow and the Buddha made of wood. Cannot go through fire. If he does, he will surely burn. There's a koan. There's a very, very, very difficult koan. It comes up in the miscellaneous koans. Okay, here it says the stone woman's loom stops. What's a stone woman? The stone woman. You know. I mean, when I look at this, and again, there's different interpretation. That's a woman that has gone beyond identity, beyond somewhat a stone woman, flesh, a stone woman, someone that is a stone woman. Okay, I won't say any more than that. The stone woman's loom stops, and the color of the night turns to noon. The color of the night turns to noon. So here, again, poetry, please get into this. The color of the night, what's night? It's dark. But dark quite often means we can't see anything. Everything is gone. There's goneness, emptiness, everything is gone. We've realized, comes back to the head. We've realized, okay, the color of the night, the color of that experience that we have, where we see, we can no longer differentiate, turns to noon, turns to clarity. So there's that beautiful image of noon turning into clarity. Turns to night. The wood person, again, wood person. Okay. The wood person walks on the road and the moon is gone beyond the midnight. And the moon is gone. So again, that image, walking on the road. Okay. The moon is gone. So it's walking, but it's not pitch black. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to walk. So walking on this dark road. So the darkness is gone beyond the midnight. It's like the image here is of total integration, that integration of that dark and that night, that integration of that head and the tail. So this is poetry. Poetry as in referring to the koan. Not easy. And by the way, we don't study this in our curriculum, so you don't have to think that you have to go through all of this in the Dr. Sun room. This is just what Bancho wrote as an appreciating verse to this to what he got out of that koan when he collected the koan collections and on this particular koan, that's the verse that he came up with. So thank you.